May 12th, 2020 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week what I did for this project is I focused on some changes to the website, and I'll talk about that a little later once a few more people show up. Anyway, that's it for me. We finally finished. We're in the middle of dealing with finals and grading and getting the grades in. So all part of the professor stuff. Anyway, next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Yes, I spent the last week probably doing some C coding, I guess, and also casting about for some other projects. Really not a lot of excitement. I guess that's it. Over.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have David in N1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Hi there. Interesting. Every time I pop in and I'm immediately on the hot seat. But nothing too much to share at this point. Been continuing to look at the magnetometer project, but no new results as of today. So 73.
And David, the thing is, you pop in and I start at the list where I am and go down, and we have the Dave cubed. So, or David's cubed. So,
yes, it's the David show.
That's right. Next on the list, we have Dev. Go ahead, Dev.
Hello, good evening. So, I'm in the league as well, same as other Davids. So, I have been working on the science question that I said last week, trying to see if DigiSondre can be used, can be the better device to be installed in the SDR. So we're following on that discussion, and we're working towards it. And nothing more interesting, exciting, other than that. Thank you.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Homan, KD2MCR. Go ahead.
Hi, good evening. I've been working on some documentation to describe magnetometer installation and testing procedures, which I have already shared on Google Doc. Hopefully, because you guys can access to this document, so you can work on to take a look at this document to see if there's anything to edit or revise. That's something that we can discuss today. So that people can take a look at this and then use as a guide. But I'd like to discuss this tonight. That's all I have right now.
Fine business, and we will do that. And next on the list, we have Mike, AA8K, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. And next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Good evening, Dave. Nice to hear you in the group. Things are going fine here in Scranton. We're still, locked down, as I'm sure everybody is. And let's see, we are wrapping up. This is the last week of classes for me, too. So we'll have finals next week, but I've got two more days of remote Zoom teaching. Contest University is this Thursday. WGNF, back to net.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening, everybody on the list. See, the last week, I put together a power estimate for Tangerine SDR, both from the equipment and also then consumption from the battery, which accounts for power supply inefficiency. And sent that off to the University of Houston, which is doing some planning work. So I'm sure it'll take them a while to digest the numbers, but at least we have an initial estimate. And that's about it this week.
Well, fine business. And I even went and took a look at your new GNU radio code. So you've been busy fellow. Next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
All right. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. And thanks again for running the show here. It's always appreciated, even though you might not say it too often. But thanks. And let's see, this week, spent most of the time on the magnetometer. Jerry and Nathaniel talked me out of the lightning sensor, seeing as how they didn't think it was really useful, more like a toy sensor. So that's that feature's gone off the board. We're going to do the lightning detection with the HF radio, so or maybe a VLF radio, and we get the RF section extended down below 100 kilohertz, or come up with a new one, or a new one or a modified one. Anyway, so the lightning sensor's gone, so I've been working on cleaning that all up, and I actually have a preliminary placement from Dave, who and we're working on that. So when I get that, I'll put that out to the powers that be here. And I do have a couple of questions I'd like to talk to Hillman and Dave W. about on the layout issues. So that's about where we're at today. Oh, and Dave, thank you for sending that email off to the folks at P&I. You're faster than me, so it pretty much answered my questions, although I think I may have a few more technical ones. And I don't know if she's the one to send them to, but maybe when we get in the general discussion, we can figure that out. Anyway, back to you, Dave. Thanks.
Fine business. And Bill, AB4EJ, got your times right this week. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks, Dave. Good evening to you and good evening to the net. Been pretty busy doing a couple of major things. Been preparing data a lot. A big package of data for 2018 and 2019 for Nathaniel for studying spots from RBN and WhisperNet, and a similar package for Felipe in Portugal, who wants to study what happened in 2018 on PSK. And both of these are kind of involve a tremendous amount of data processing because the data files are enormous. And right now, I realized one thing I can do on creating a publicly available package of all of this data, get away from using a database and store the files as CSV files. Been working with the guys at MIT a little bit about maybe making it available through Madrigal. I'm having to convert some code from C# to C to just run in C. Get it to run faster, to do the conversions, etc. It's not tangerine related. On tangerine related stuff, I worked quite a bit this week on making the connectivity between the small board computer and the data engine smoother for automatically making the connection, setting up the channel, selecting the hot frequencies, and make sure that the data that comes back from that is correct and is visible and works fine in HDF view. And I also prepared I added several pages to the interface document, the localhost to data engine, and published that on the mailing list. I'm looking for comments back from that on how all the way down to the byte details on how the DE and the LH communicate with regard to setting up channels and configuration of all of that. The data, setting up the data, well, that is working, but I just don't have that in the documentation yet, so I'll be adding that. So anyway, back to net.
Well, fine business, and that brings us to the end of the list. I did want to mention, if you haven't taken a look at the Tangerine SDR website, I reorganized the side menus and added project components, which are both boards and things like Bill's localhost software. So it could be a software project or it could be a hardware project. But I want to make a place that if somebody's coming and trying to figure out the project, each of the pieces will be there and explained and links to the code so that people can build that. It's easier for us, it's easier to keep them in like working documents, but for people trying to learn, I think they find it easier working board by board. Also, I added a link for TeamSpeak help, which has it tells you where to get TeamSpeak, tells you the common problems that people have and solutions for those. So take a look, and any feedback is welcome. We're open for general discussion.
Well, I think those links look very good there, Dave. I do think it's a lot easier for to kind of understand where things are when you're learning about it if it's organized like that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I have a
Would it be possible to go one step farther and to include links to the documents like underneath those headings? Because when you go to look at the working documents, like everything's there, but the names are a little bit more cryptic.
Yes, I planned on that, what's called the project components. Each of the smaller size lines will be a link to another web page. And I'm envisioning something analogous to what was done on OpenHPSDR with each of the boards. So it tells you, it gives you design documents, all those things, but I'm doing it in pieces, working my way through it. But I wanted to include the boards, the local software, the network software things, and I may have jumped the gun a little bit saying that somebody's going to build a summary data reporter and a science data server, but I expect those would have to be part of the system somewhere.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, Dave, I'd like to suggest a few changes to the board names to make them consistent with what we've been using throughout.
Yes, we can do that. Which ones were you thinking about?
Oh, I'll send you a list, but like the RF board is really the RF module, and the timing board is really the clock module. So I want to make sure we use consistent nomenclature so it makes it a little easier, I think.
Oh, okay. Yes. I was just trying to make clear that some things are boards and some things are software and some things are like the single board computer is not a board on the actual data engine. It's a computer that you put with it.
Right, right. And actually it becomes the local host, right?
Correct.
Speaking of that, I remember I just have this idea in my mind that in the past it has been mentioned to me on a couple of occasions that maybe we should evaluate some additional single board computers besides the one I'm working with, which is the Odroid. And I'm happy to do that if somebody would just tell me which ones I should try in addition to the Odroid. I'll buy them and test them, but I'm not really an expert on all these. There's so many of them. If anybody has any suggestions, I'm certainly open to hear what those are.
Hi, Bill. This is Tom. I've had a number of people ask me about the Raspberry Pi 4. So when I put together the power estimates for UOH, I put in the power estimates for a Pi 4 because they're not going to have a disk. They're just going to record data on their balloon flight to the SD card. So there seems to be people who have kind of lower expectations in terms of data recording that are kind of looking at an inexpensive platform.
Well, Tom, on that, what amount of data are we expecting to be able to collect on that kind of device? We're not going to have a disk. I'll have to look into how much memory you can put on a Raspberry Pi 4 and what other chips you can put on it. But do you have any idea?
Well, yeah, typical 32 gig memory card is very common. And so that would limit, for their 2-hour balloon flight, that would limit them to, 30 gig or something of data storage, because they probably have 2 or 3 or 4 gig of, peripherals and OS and stuff. And then, of course, the Pi 4, you can get in 1, 2, or 4 gigs of RAM. But, it's something that a lot of folks are familiar with.
Okay, I'll get some of those and try them. I do want to make sure that we cover the widest path, the widest bandwidth of things that things people are actually going to use, and test that way.
Yeah, on the four, it's, you know, it's not going to have anywhere near the data throughput that the Odroid will have. So I think the folks I've talked to have said they're willing to throttle back what they do to fit within the capabilities of the well-known board.
Bill, I do think that the Odroid is a good representative of that class of boards. There may be a better final choice, but you're not going to be going far wrong in that case, unless somebody wants to go to some of the embedded Ryzens or something that's truly a different architecture.
Yeah, Bill, I was thinking of maybe the Vim 3 as something similar to the Odroid in performance, but a little smaller and maybe a little bit less power hungry.
Oh, is that Victor India Mike Vim 3?
That's correct.
But from a software perspective, it's not gonna be very different, except for perhaps full out data gathering.
Right. Well, I guess with regard to the Raspberry Pi 4, if it's going to be, we're going to plan to use it for a balloon flight. I guess we'll have to. I mean, how many? Do you have any idea how many different frequencies they want to try? And because, you know, you can get more resolution on a given frequency if you have less frequencies. But, you know, I guess I don't have a good feel for what it is that they want to collect. Have they explained that in any kind of detail?
Nathaniel and I had a call with them. I don't recall them saying exactly what they wanted. Their statement at the time was they want something, you know, small, compact with an SD memory card and not an external disk. And they were willing to throttle back their RF collection requirements to meet that. Nathaniel, did you hear any specifics from the UOH folks?
No, I don't remember any specifics in particular, but what you said sounds about right.
Bill, I would like to mention one other one that both Dave Witten and I have been testing is a NVIDIA Nano, which does have a GPIO pin set, and so it seems to work with the things that I've tested so far. We're not doing a lot of GPU programming, but it's in the ballpark because it's just at $100, and so it's really in that price range.
Okay, I'll take a look at those. But as far as the, as you said, the if we already have an existing use case of folks who are anxious to actually use this, we want to make sure we give priority to that and anything else that we think is going to appeal to a lot of people. So I will definitely take a look at all of those. I got the Raspberry Pi 4, the NVIDIA Nano, and the Vim 3. I'll take a look at all of those in addition to the Odroid and see if, you know, if I find any particular reason that presents problems or makes any of them especially good for this application. And then see if we can have a system that will run on all of them.
Sounds good.
Actually, Dan, who's trying to join, is good chance he's has an idea or two about that.
Dan, are you there?
Yes, Dave, I am here.
Welcome. And do you have any comments? I wanted to, and we've been talking about what Bill wanted to try some of the alternative single board computers, and the suggestions were a Raspberry Pi 4, a Vim 3, and a Nano in addition to the Odroid N2.
Yes, those are the ones that I have looked at. I have also been, I've had my eyes open for some new ones. There are a couple of them. Hold on just a second while I think about this. I'd actually promised Bill about a month ago that I was going to put a list up on the list of new single board computers up, and I haven't done that yet, so I apologize for being a little tardy. I'll try to get that done in the next day or so.
Hey, Dan, did you see the Odroid C4?
Yes, I did. And that's one I was actually thinking of. It's fairly comparable in performance to the Raspberry Pi 4. It's a little cheaper, actually, in the 4 gig memory version. And I think it is just becoming available, like maybe in the last week or so.
Odroid has them in stock right now, according to their website.
Yeah, good deal. I think the 4 gig model is $51, roughly.
50.0, from what I can see here. They only list one model. Are there two memory models?
I thought there was a 2 gig and a 4 gig model. I might be wrong about the 2 gig model. Not sure. Yeah, I think I mentioned the last time we talked about this that it's really a combination of the computer and the OS that's available for it, and to some degree, the software that's available for it. I mean, the Raspberry Pi, for example, you know, most people use Raspbian. Some people use Ubuntu Mate or Ubuntu Mate, whatever you want to call it. And I think that it's a lot more the combination of the two than it is either the board or the OS.
Yeah, this looks like the Raspberry Pi 4 and the C4, Odroid C4, are pretty much a dead heat.
Yeah, I did see a YouTube video that I think the guy on Explaining Computers did, and he mentioned the very same thing. And there is another channel called ETA Prime. It's actually the letters ETA space Prime. And the guy does a lot of reviews on emulation systems for old games. But some of the other reviews he does are talks about some of the new stuff that's coming out. There's another one called the Seed Odyssey X86 that is probably pretty promising in that it will run mainstream. I mean, it's powerful enough to run mainstream Linux distributions, which I think in this day and age is a good thing. The downside of it is it's fairly expensive. I think it's in the neighborhood of $160 to $170 for the full-blown 4-gig memory version.
Yeah, but that runs an x86 processor, right?
It does. It runs a Celeron, I believe.
Yeah, the main thing, if they say that the C4 does better than the Raspberry Pi 4, is memory speed. Everything else is pretty much tied.
Yeah, the only downside of the Odroid boards is that they don't have onboard Wi-Fi.
Is that really a problem for us?
I don't think it's a big problem for us. I mean, it's a problem for me personally because I do most of my connection by Wi-Fi, but it's kind of cumbersome to do the Odroid dongles. For whatever reason, they never seem to work as well as they should.
Yeah, we have discussed this before. One of the things that would be just the cat's pajamas if anybody came out with a single board computer that had more than one Ethernet port on it, so that we could have a dedicated port for connecting to the data engine and another one for connecting to the rest of the network and be able to get some isolation between them for security. But that's probably not very high on the priority list of people who make these kind of systems.
Yeah, the Odroid, I'm sorry, not the Odroid, but the Seed Odyssey X86, I believe, has two Ethernet ports.
I know these Raven boards that I've been using for the Antarctic project, they have two Ethernets, but those boards are also very expensive and probably will not be appropriate for this project.
Yeah, and this... what C4 board has eMMC on it, which is pretty amazing for such a cheap board.
Yeah, but I think you end up having to pay extra for eMMC.
Yeah, I guess you do. But what do you get on the Raspberry Pi 4 besides SD card for booting?
That's about it. Although I have seen a couple of schemes that people have come up with to actually boot them with a hard drive.
Well, how do they do that? Do they use a SATA adapter on USB?
I think they start the boot on the SD card and then move it to the hard drive fairly quickly.
I think that's pretty out there.
Now, how much faster is a hard drive than a premium SD card, especially on reads?
Yeah, probably not a lot faster, all things considered.
The eMMC 5, all the Odroids use eMMC. They've really never released any that didn't have it that I'm aware of, back to some old ones that I have, real old ones.
Yeah, my first board was the XU4, and it, of course, I think I bought a 16-gig eMMC board for that one.
I've really never trusted using SD cards day in and day out as a boot medium. I've never had them last that long.
And they aren't particularly fast either, compared to the eMMC.
Well, there is a big difference between SD cards, and I mean, there are some of the older ones were pretty awful. The newer ones tend to be a lot better, but as Dave mentioned, the reliability of them is suspect always.
Yeah, these days I don't buy anything that's slower than like a U1, but even those are kind of slow now.
Yeah, but it's the difference between a, you know, a 16 gig card for $6 and a 16 gig card for $20.
Yep, it certainly is. So I usually wait until they're on sale and buy the high-end Samsungs when I can get them, because the cheap cards just aren't worth the wait. Because if you're a photographer, you would have found that out a lot long ago, right? The cheap cards aren't worth it.
Well, the Germans have a saying, we can't afford to buy cheap things.
Yeah, I'm with that. That's a cool saying.
Yeah, there's a lot to that.
Yeah, you can't afford to buy something that'll do the job, but you can afford to buy three of them that won't.
Yeah, people have criticized me for what I pay for dog health care insurance, but when we had thousands of dollars in medical bills for our dogs when they got snake bitten and everything else last week, Nationwide picked up all of it except for like a $50 deductible. I was very pleased.
Well, you got your money's worth then.
Yeah, it's expensive, but man, when you need it, it really, really helps. The small one, Ethel is her name. She's on the mend. She had an appointment with two different doctors today. The one that's monitoring her anemia and the one in Birmingham. Imagine that, going to Birmingham for your dog. But anyway, for her, she's got a mitral valve failure. But the doctor there said, both doctors says that she's doing very well, and we don't have to bring her back for many months. So she's over the hump, at least we hope. So that's a good thing.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, I find usually the people that say you're wasting your money on dog insurance or on vet bills are the kind of people that say, well, it's just a dog. You should just put it down when it gets sick. Obviously, people who've never owned a dog that they cared about.
Yeah, well, now, you know, we don't have kids living with us, so the dogs become like family members. So anyway, I don't mean to sidetrack the conversation, since it was just a follow-up on last week's conversation about the same topic. So anyway, enough said.
Okay, well, I have a couple questions for Dave W., maybe on the magnetometer. Can I answer that email that you sent out with some technical questions? Is that the right venue, or is there someone else I should ask?
To the best of my knowledge, she's the one to connect with. She doesn't usually respond like the next day. It takes a couple, 3 days, but she does respond well. And yeah, I think is it Betty or Zhang or something like that? But she's the one. She's the one I know of who seems to deal with that stuff.
Okay, because we were looking at me and the CAD guy were looking at the layout instructions. What we're planning to do is we're planning to lay out the PC board with the chip and the inductors, so that if at any future time we can't get the boards, even though it seems like they're willing to sell us boards, if we can't get the development kit boards, we can at least buy the parts and solder them on ourselves. And it looks like they've got enough instruction there that we can figure out how to do it so that they'll be oriented properly, except that if you look at their two diagrams, the one in the for the board, the development board, and the one for the kit of parts that tells you how to orient the inductors, they aren't consistent between themselves. So we're kind of at a loss as to how to do it. I think what we're going to do is we're going to lay it out so that if you don't have the plug-in board and you put the chips on and the individual pieces on, they will be oriented the exact same way as the plug-in board. So either or will work the exact same way.
Yeah, I think it would be really good to ask. I think it's a good idea, too, to put those footprints on your design. And though these folks do seem to be good and competent, there are some little glitches. I've found a bug or two in some of their demo app and things, and so it's well worth asking. But they respond well if you have follow up question is to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah. So one of the questions is if we put I've told my CAD guy no components underneath the board. So there'll either be components underneath the board and no board, or there'll be no components underneath the board and a plug-in board. So the question is, are the traces and footprints underneath the board that we're going to plug in going to affect the plug-in board at all? No magnetic material, but copper will be there.
I kind of doubt it, but I have no science to base that on.
Well, maybe Heelman can weigh in on this. I'm asking if copper traces within, say, a half an inch of the magnetometer coils, would you think that would adversely affect the operation of the coils?
Copper, I mean, as long as it's pure copper, it shouldn't. It's actually widely used for magnetic sensors as a magnetic sensor structure. So copper or aluminum, plastic, of course, wood. The copper should be fine as long as it doesn't. Is that a ground plane or just?
No, it would be some traces that we would put components on, but they would be optional components. So in case we wanted to build the board, in case we couldn't get the plug-in module anymore, we could still solder down the parts on the board and have a magnetometer. But in the normal case, the first build, we wouldn't install any components there. So there'd just be traces underneath the board that we plug in, and no components. No other components under there either, just copper traces. And we could put a ground plane on another layer below it, but I don't know whether that would be useful or that would be bad. Generally, I was thinking use it as a big keep-out area and don't put anything there except the traces for the components that will be optional.
So it's a thin layer, right?
Yeah, it'd be 1 ounce copper, so a couple of 3 mils maybe.
I don't see any problem there because usually coppers are fine.
Yeah, so Scott. Yeah, Scotty, this is Tom. One consideration you might want to avoid any shorted loops in the copper because a loop might, form a shorted turn on an inductor, which might impact the inductor.
Okay, so we can do that because when the components are installed underneath the magnetometer board, then you won't be plugging one in. So it'll be only no components under there when using a plug-in board. And I think, that's doable without too much trouble.
Yeah, for example, if you had a ground plane and, there was a couple of traces that went out somewhere else and then back down to the ground plane again, you might form a shorted loop.
So, like, we shouldn't use put like a guard band around some pins or something.
Yeah, you're just trying to avoid something that could magnetically couple into the loops, and a metal ring might impact it a little bit.
But a solid ground plane should be fine because we're not there's nothing magnetic about it.
Yeah, I think so. My concern again is forming an annulus or a ring that would magnetically couple to one of the coils.
Well,
I at least as a first reaction, I would think a copper ground plane on the bottom side of the board would be somewhat desirable, because you're going to be sitting this on top of the single board computer, perhaps, and who knows what's down there.
Yeah, and that's a good point to shield it from all that. But again, that's going to be more electrical stuff. But again, that's what the copper does best, to shield the electric fields, and the magnetic fields will still come through.
Yeah, you could put some mu metal in there, but that gets complicated and expensive.
Yeah, well, I think copper, as long as it's not thick, super thick, it shouldn't be a problem. You know, it's just like some of you guys mentioned, as long as it doesn't leak, create any kind of loop that can create some kind of inductance there, it shouldn't be a problem, I think. And then in some sensors, they actually intentionally use copper to shield some high frequency noise. So that's, I think, for me, I don't see any big problem.
Okay, because the copper will be about a half an inch away from the coils, because it'll be down on the main board and the coils will be on the plug-in board on those connectors that raise the board up a little bit. But I do want to keep all the components out from under there and as far away from the coils as possible. Don't know that that's going to be a problem, because those parts are all slaves. So, I mean, they get accessed by the Raspberry Pi, but they are when their access is under control of the Pi. So if you have interference problems, you ought to be able to fix it in software. Anyway,
go ahead.
I was just going to say we're going to be done pretty soon here this week.
Sounds good. Yeah, so speaking of the magnetometer, mechanical structure and noise and stuff, I'd like to bring this to your attention that I have wrote some description on magnetometer testing and insulation procedures in. And I shared a document on Google. I don't know if, Nathaniel, would that be okay to share this document directly so that people can add things or fix things here directly? Or is there any other place to share this document?
Yeah, that's fine with me. Keep a backup copy for yourself and just share it with everybody, another copy with everyone, and let them go ahead and make some comments.
Okay, so the one thing that I like to mention here is actually some necessary tests. One is noise level. So the major issue of this sensor is that it has never been used for this type of purpose. And I have looked at the specification sheet very briefly, and some of the information on some of the performance are not really there. So although probably we can figure things out on the way, but some of the tests needs to be done so that we can make sure that this is performing as expected. So the first thing is actually noise level test to make sure that it's actually below a certain noise level. One way to do it is to have some shielding case, which I actually included in the document to see how the shielding case looks like. We have one at NGIT, and I think Dave McCarr, at Dartmouth, I think he has one at Dartmouth College, and I believe some other folks mentioned that the his lab has shielding case as well, so we can make sure that zero is zero is zero, and we can characterize noise level. Also, there could be some bias, maybe due to how we design the circuitry and stuff. So we just want to make sure that under this noise condition, there's no other noise other than the some expected noise coming from the sensor or electronics. The other thing that we need to consider is to look at whether it will show, of course, sensitivity. We have to come up with the conversion factor. I don't know. We have reached this step in terms of specifying data units. For example, right now, probably the output is in voltage, and we have to convert that voltage into a scientifically meaningful unit, physical unit, which is nanotesla or Gauss or millitesla, whatever. So that's something that we need to figure out, voltage to nanotesla, that kind of conversion factor. The other one is temperature response. I don't really know whether this this type of new type of sensor has temperature response. It is really well known in flux gate magnetometer that flux gate magnetometer does really show sensitivity in different ambient temperature. So we have to compensate that temperature variation. I have already included some example of temperature response in the document, so you guys can see what I meant by temperature response. You know, actually gain changes depending on the ambient temperature. So that's something that we need to discuss.
Well, PNI claims that the module, the part is temperature compensated already, but that remains to be seen.
Oh, okay, that's cool. Okay.
Because it seems, I think they have a processor in the module. It sounds to me is like what it's like the Wi-Fi modules, the modern ones that have an STM processor co-resident with whatever sensors they need, and the processor actually runs the show, so they can do compensation and things like that.
Oh, sounds really good. Okay. Yeah, so the especially like in-house flux gate magnetometer, you really have to have some temperature compensation logic in the processing. So, but if that's already taken care of, that's really nice. And the other thing is long-term drift. Well, a lot of things that I mentioned here is based on my experience when I was dealing with flux gate magnetometer, which is quite sensitive, and it's pretty powerful instrument, but at the same time, it's very picky depending on the temperature and depending on the time. For example, like there's a long-term drift. Usually, a rare reported value is a few nanotesla per year. So they change, especially if you want to install this type of magnetometer for a long time, if you want to see the long-term variation, a few nanotesla could be, I mean, depending on science, but it could be significant for some field of studies. So, but of course, we never tested this for a long time. So long-term drift is something that we need to keep in mind. You know, maybe we can take a look at the long-term data set to see how it looks like. So that's also described here. And the last section is about installation. How are we going to install this? What should be considered? Of course, noise source. You know, you don't want to have noise source around. You know, you don't want to have a big motor around, like, you know, very commonsensical stuff. But also, we would recommend to have some kind of proper housing just to, you know, keep it safe mechanically. Like, it could be very simple, low-cost solution, like maybe, you know, trash bin, like plastic trash bin upside down. But then probably we need some kind of insulation inside, maybe just crude, you know, pink insulation material just to minimize the temperature variation, daily variation and stuff like that. So I added very simple diagram. So I hope you guys take a look at this document.
Oh, okay. Where can we get it? Where is it?
It's in...
Hillman, why don't you just share the link in the chat?
Yeah, I'm not sure what Google Drive you're referring to, so...
Here, hold on. I'll put the link in the chat for everybody. Where you have it? Yeah, Hillman just posted it.
Yeah, I just did.
Okay, I got it.
So I have a description on sensor housing and sensor orientation. I believe, sensor orientation is very important just to make our data set constant among the other data sets. So I hope you guys can take a look at this and then see if you can, if it makes sense, or if you see something that needs to be more clarified, let me know, or maybe you guys are welcome to make some edits wherever needed. But please use some suggestion mode so we can see, we can track all the edits so we can be on the same page. So that's all I have right now. And maybe you guys can take a look at this document and see if there's anything that we need to discuss right now. So please let me know.
Yeah, it looks like the PNI orientation, they call it NED, northeast and down, and that looks like the same orientation that you're using. So I think we can orient them the same direction.
That's really nice. I think that's really designed for this type of application.
The problem is, if you look at their layouts, their layouts are different, and so I'm not sure. I know that the X and the Y coils are the same, but they are not symmetrical. So there actually is a pin 1, and you have to get the pin 1 connected to the right terminal. Otherwise, you end up going 180 degrees out, is what I'm guessing. But I need more clarification from PNI.
Or just maybe put some, flip the sign maybe then?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, so instead of being NED, it might be SWD.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know, is that just flipping the sign? Because, you know, what comes in from the east goes out on the west, so it would seem like that would be logical, but I don't know how this thing actually measures.
So one thing we can do, the easy solution is to come up with, to bring a compass needle, looking at the compass needle, and orient the whatever the axis along the needle to make sure that, for example, X output is maximum, which is northward, magnetic north, and the Y component, which is pointing either west or east, has to be minimum, like close to zero. That means, you know, x-axis, the primary axis, x-axis is along the magnetic field line, which is actually parallel to the compass needle. That's it. But the z has to be toward the center of the earth, which means that xy plane has to be leveled using a bubble or whatever. So that's, yeah.
Right, so the X and Y coils, the east-west coil is located on a north-south axis, which makes sense, but you have to connect the pin 1 to the positive output of the oscillator on the chip, and pin 2 goes to the negative. And the same thing for the north-south facing one. Of course, it's on an east-west axis, and you connect the pin 1 to the positive and the pin 2 to the negative. But then when you go to the Z sensor, it mounts like a pyramid, like a little obelisk on the top of the board, and it measures downward. But I'm not convinced. But they show two orientations, pin 1 to the south and pin 1 to the north. Now, I think since it's measuring up and down, the rotation of it probably doesn't make any difference as long as you mount it by exactly vertical.
Okay, I see. All right.
Anyway, and then when you look at the PC board, the development board that we all have, that Dave has found and used on his, that we will also use, if you look at the orientation of the X and Y coils, they're 180 degrees out. The pin ones are on the wrong side compared to the diagram that they show, the way you should install them. So I'm kind of at a loss as to how to do it. And I'm thinking I'm going to just copy the way the board is, because whatever it is, whether it's right or wrong, I don't think there's a right or wrong. I think that we just all ought to be consistent.
I really think that's the approach to take. I believe some of the confusion may have to do with an earlier product that was a little different. Perhaps the RM3000 or one of the other ones, the Sky Scout or whatever they called it, which seemed to be kind of, some of them are just backwards of everything we're doing.
Well, from what I can tell from the RM3000, that's the exact same ASIC chip, but only with X and Y sensors and no Z sensor. Is that what you understand too?
I honestly hadn't looked at, I know it only did X and Y, but I don't remember. I never looked at it real hard since we wanted all three. But there's also some other predecessors to all this. And some of the document, you know how documentation is, people cut and paste and forget to edit.
Yeah, it's just in one of those documents that you sent me, or that Betty sent us, and you forwarded on. It It actually talked about the 3000 and the 3100 and the fact that the 3000 was exactly the same as the 3100 without the Z sensor. So same part, same coils for X and Y, just no Z. So that's kind of where I got that from.
Yeah, I've not been reading the documentation other than the code related stuff anymore since not involved in that, but the so I didn't pay real close attention to what she sent. It seemed like she alluded to yet some other documentation that might be available as well. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I think what I'd like to see, I'm going to ask for this and see what she says. I'd like to see the Gerber plots for the board. You know, I'd like to see how they did the layout, because I'd like to do the same exact copy of the layout underneath their board so that it would act exactly the same.
I it sounds like they wouldn't have any objection to giving you that, but you never know till you ask.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't need Gerbers. I just need a DXF or something that shows me the layers, because you can't see anything on the existing board. And the stuff that you sent me for Hamcation, did you send me a 3100 board?
I sure thought I did. I think, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure I put one on one. Did I give you two larger boards or just one? I'm sure I gave you the breakout board, one of the magnetometer breakout boards.
Okay, I'm going to go look for it, because it's stashed in with all my mock-up stuff, and I'm not sure where it is. It's still packed away from coming back from Hamcation. So, but then I'd have a physical board I could actually look at to, you know, try to copy the... So the layout's not going to be too hard, but the routing is going to be hard without any, some kind of Gerbers.
I'm sure it can be sorted out. She certainly said that, yeah, I guess you want the physical, so... she certainly said that she would provide us with documentation on the module itself, which really surprised me.
Yeah, I know you directly asked her for a schematic, and she said no problem.
They've been very cooperative, but sometimes you have to ask them exactly what you want. I got a lot of good stuff from her, but I had no hint that there existed some Arduino libraries from this until after Frankie apparently asked for it and got them. So there were Arduino libraries for this as well, which would have been real useful at one stage.
Yeah, I think most of these outfits will be cooperative and give you what you want, but you have to specifically ask for it, which I haven't. So I'll go ahead and do that. That will be helpful, I think, for our CAD guy. And also, one other thing, have you found any use for the D-Ready pin? Is there a use to having that connected up to an interrupt line or have it be able to interrupt the processor?
Not that I have been... either I pulled it low or ignored it completely, whatever it was I was supposed to do with it. But it's not for our purposes. I think there's a D-Ready register that my code pulls in before it takes it, you know, before it asks for data. And so I don't need the pin.
Right, but if you had the pin, you could maybe use it to detect changes that so you wouldn't have to continuously poll.
Well, the poll is just a, you know, is just a loop on the on that status register. I think, yeah, I know what you mean, but actually putting, you know, making this code interrupt based might or might not be worth it. I haven't seen any need for it, and none of the examples I saw seem to be doing it that way. And when I sorted it out, it seemed to be something to for another day.
Okay, well, I'm just looking forward to the day when maybe this isn't the only peripheral that the Pi is trying to manage. So anyway, we connected it up. You can ignore it if you want, and that's fine. And maybe we all will, but if somebody can find a use for it, then it might be useful. And it's basically free to connect it up, so thought we'd try that.
As long as it doesn't have to be pulled high or low or something, probably is perfectly sensible to break it out.
Yeah, and we even have a way for the remote board to pull the IRQ also.
Yeah.
So anyway, sometime tomorrow I should be able to write you a note and see if we can get an answer from those guys on a couple questions. That would be awesome.
I'd love it if you'd copy me on that, because just so I know what you're asking. So if something turns up that I need to know, because I am still fiddling with the code.
Oh, I definitely will.
Of course, the code I'm writing is all for the single board computer, and it's really, I guess it'll be used for testing, but it doesn't apply to, you know, the end product here.
Yeah, by the way, which I2C port are you using? Are you using the one that's on pins like, 2 and 4? No, 1, 2, 2, 4, 4 and 6?
I'm using the low-numbered one that's almost, when the question, talking about different boards, different single-board computers, and different OSs on a given single board computer, the mapping of those pins can vary. It's really determined on these ARM chips by the device tree database, and typically only the low numbered one is actually active. Actually, on the Raspberry Pis, I think it isn't necessarily activated at first when you first start it up at all. But the differences between these boards is mostly in just exactly how, not only how they, what pins they activate. There's, you know, the Odroids usually have at least two I2C pairs of pins. But what, in the operating system, what device they map that as, on the Raspberry Pi 3s and 4s, I think it's one. On the N2s, Odroid N2s, it's I2C-2. On some of the ones like the NVIDIA Nano, I don't know, the Nano, the Xavier, it's maps, the low number one goes to I2C-8. It's all over the place. And these are things we're going to have to document, because there's two things. One, what the software setup is for any given single board computer, and this doesn't have to be changed in the data engine, but it can be changed. You know, it can be for the most part can be handled in the it won't even be a problem. You'll be dealing with it differently. But anyway, these things are different. Most of these boards come up with that bus operating at a higher frequency than the 100K that we've specified, and I've been setting the N2s to 100K explicitly. I worked out the process for doing that. I have that written down. I will post that on the website sooner or later.
Okay, because I'm looking at the Pi header, and it looks like there's only two I2C ports, default I2C ports. One of them used for the ID-ROM, and the other one is, they don't identify it, it's SDA1 and SCL1 are the two ports. So I guess one is the I2C port, but it's on pins 3 and 5 of the connector. So is that where you're strapping in to hook the module in when you hook it up to a Pi?
Yes.
Okay, perfect, because that was the two pins I was planning to use on the hat. And I think the Odroid has them on the same, has an I2C on the same two pins, although they may have more I2C somewhere else, but I know they have one there.
Virtually all of them have that one I2C mapped there. What it appears as in the operating system can vary a lot.
And that is, there's nothing on the Raspberry Pi itself connected to that I2C, right?
Not that I'm aware of. That's usually the one that's favored for user monkeying around with.
Okay, good. Because I didn't want to pick an address that would conflict with something.
I will mention we were just past our time.
Okay. Everybody's as tired as I am?
I think I'm doing okay. Just to let Bill know that I am currently de-chunking the file he sent me, and I'm sorting everything out into one-day files.
Okay, very good. Yeah. I just sent you something on that. I am going to get all the PSK stuff done, but it's probably going to take some months to get all of it.
Yeah, it'd be good to have that eventually. I'll have to talk about this some more.
Also, I noticed there's a thing called an Odroid H2. Has two Ethernet ports, is x86 architecture. It's going to have some of those available in June, so maybe we'll have to take a look at that too.
Yeah, they've had very, very spotty availability. Apparently, Intel isn't dedicating many of the chips to these guys.
Yeah, it's also a little bit more expensive too, but it may limit its appeal for us, but. Anyway, it is another one that if anybody is that interested in security, that they want to have the additional Ethernet port, that's an option.
So you said it's an H2 or an HC2?
The one I saw on the website is the Odroid Hotel 2 H2.
If you really want added Ethernet ports, there are quite a few boards built with specifically that in mind. Maybe more around the NXP ARM chips but they seem to be more kind of like router and oriented, but they're similar to other chips architecturally.
Yeah, the problem is you got too much choice.
This looks like a pretty performant board, Bill. It has SODIMMs for memory.
Yeah, it looks like, I mean, it's kind of expensive, like $115 or something, what I've seen. But it looks like it's like a lot of these little boards. They're the equivalent of what a lot of people use as a desktop.
They're pretty interesting, but Intel's commitment to this part of the market has always been, at best, erratic.
Right, yeah, I understand.
Looks like they got an NVMe module with a 4-lane PCI 2, so that's going to be pretty fast. And actually, in the end, I guess the VIM-3 costs, you know, fully outfitted, costs about the same as this one. Maybe a little bit less, but not much. Of course, I bet this price doesn't include the SODIMMs. So this is basically a 0-gig memory model here.
You talking about the Odroid H2?
Yeah, all the memory is on SODIMM, so it ships with no memory.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, once you put everything on it, you probably spend a lot.
But anyway, I think we should consider high-end replacements or high-end alternatives. So I would not rule this out just for cost alone if you get the performance that you... If you get what you pay for.
I would really look at the NVIDIA module-based things as well. It's complicated to sort out, but they have an awful lot of what you want. Just nobody's packaging it quite this way.
Yeah, well, the thing about this one with the two Ethernet ports, you get two managed ports instead of the two unmanaged ports on the... single board computer. I mean, on the data engine.
I think there's a good case for that.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe if the case is good enough, we should just dump the two ports on the data engine. But it almost comes for free because you got to put a PHY on there anyway. And the difference between the dual PHY and the single PHY is, you know, $2. So really the extra connector is what costs the most. And if you buy a stacked connector, even that comes way down.
Right.
So perhaps in the local case where you're not really going out on the net, but you need two ports, that's useful.
So Scotty, how's the layout coming on the data engine?
Actually, we haven't started on that because the magnetometer snuck in ahead of it. And actually another job for another customer who has been waiting longer than the data engine. So it's going to be another couple of weeks, I think, before we start on it. But then we'll get Dave's undivided attention, so it'll go pretty fast. Because I really like to get the layout done at least, so then we can start building RF boards.
Okay, very good. So you can blame it all on a sneaky magnetometer?
Yeah, really. And it may be, there may be some changes to the RF board that we need on the data engine, because it's still, the jury's still out as to how I really am going to do the VCCIO. I mean, I've gone back and forth thinking that maybe I should just supply the VCCIO to you as the RF module and let you route it to the parts, and then you take whatever VCCIO I give you. But then if, suppose I give you the wrong one, it's still going to cause the same amount of trouble as if I gave you the wrong one now and you're using your own. So I don't know. It's trying to make it as simple as possible. And it's complicated because the banking inside the FPGA. And when you strap, when you run one bank at 1.8 volts, all the I/O in that bank runs at 1.8, including any clocks that might be in that module. So now that means that the clock module has to handle 1.8 volt clocks. So it's like this giant jigsaw puzzle you're trying to put together, and you're doing it on quicksand. Okay, well, I guess we are past our time. So anybody have anything else?
I think that's it for me tonight. I think I'll get in touch with you next week, hopefully, about what we were going to talk about last week. Next week will be after classes and after CTU, so it should be a little better for me, I think.